From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. We've been covering since it began in April an attempted coup in Nicaragua, strongly backed by the U.S. government. Over the past weeks, it's become clear that that attempted coup has failed. And for more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, based in Nicaragua, via Skype Monday. Okay, so it seems the story is actually finally turning here. The truth is coming out about what has happened in Nicaragua, and that the government has the situation pretty much in hand at this point, along with, I would say more so, being led by the people who also have made their mind up about what's going to happen, and it ain't the color revolution.
Right. Yeah, and in the regional context, what's happening in Nicaragua is probably of the first importance, and obviously I live here and I'm going to think that, aren't I? But and if you look at it in regional terms, and the United States has failed to overthrow the government in Venezuela, they thought they'd have a walkover last year, and they didn't. They failed abysmally.
Yep.
And Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, and his government team, although they face very, very serious economic difficulties as a result of the United States economic boycott and sanctions, and it looks as though they're steadily working towards a viable way of maintaining the Venezuelan economy in defense of the basic economic and social rights of the impoverished majority, certainly in Venezuela. Having failed there, the United States must have looked around and thought, well, Nicaragua's very dependent on Venezuela. They're now not getting as much support from Venezuela as they used to. If we destabilize them, they should be easy pickings. That's what they must have thought.
Yep.
In the State Department and in Miami among the terrorist mafia led by Marco Rubio and Ileana Rosletinen.
Right.
They must have thought that. They must have thought, well, Nicaragua should be easy pickings. And they started earlier this year, they started trying to take advantage of a fire in the ecological reserve, the Indio Maíz, which is a kind of biosphere reserve, a very important ecological resource in Central America, not just Central America, but all of the Americas. And they tried to set up a campaign around that. And as the usual suspects in the international media tried to stoke that campaign, The Guardian, The New York Times, claiming that the government perhaps had even started the fire and wasn't taking serious measures to combat it and so on, which is all complete falsehoods, of course.
And kind of cute when you consider, like, California has been on fire for about 5-10 years now. An awful lot of indigenous land, an awful lot of small farmers and others completely suffering huge losses, and not a peep about any of that. They treat it instead like a spectacle with heroic firemen.
So, right. Yeah, well, in the case of the Indio Maíz fire, the government did invite foreign support from the Honduran Air Force and the Salvadoran Air Force, and they helped with helicopters that were specially designed to helicopters and airplanes that were specially designed to try and put out fires. And all the propaganda to the contrary, the Nicaraguan government does enjoy good institutional relations with the United States authorities, and they invited experts from the United States to help them combat the fire.
And they're working with El Salvador and Honduras is also newsworthy, actually, because it shows the importance of these, you know, of this resource, basically, you know, containing the fire, that it's something that's trans-ideological.
Oh, yeah, no, very much so. And Costa Rica also offered to help, but they didn't have the resources. They only had land-based firefighters who were unable to reach the fire. Or the most important part of the fire. So, and the Costa Rican authorities and the Nicaraguan authorities agreed that the Costa Rican fire service wouldn't try and take part because they wouldn't be able to be very effective. But that was portrayed by The Guardian in particular and by the New York Times, as I remember, as Nicaragua rejecting help from Costa Rica.
Right.
You know, and that just completely twisting things around.
Right.
But anyway, and the back then, whenever it was when was it? February, something like that. Here in Nicaragua, everyone was benefited by the onset of rains in that part of Nicaragua, and the rains helped the firefighters get the fire under control, which
very
they did
lucky,
successfully.
Yeah, very lucky.
And in the end, despite the false claims of the opposition media, only about 0.3% of the Indio Maíz Reserve was actually destroyed by the fire. And the authorities here reckon that they'll be able to make that good within a few years. So anyway, and that happened, and then because they were unable to take advantage of that, they must have already set up the infrastructure that they needed for the coup by preparing the logistics of how they would carry out their attacks once the coup got going.
Right.
They must have got all that prepared back then when there was the controversy around the Indio Maíz fire. And when the government, very maladroitly, it has to be said, tried to implement a reform of the social security system that actually defended workers' and pensioners' rights. And it actually extended the rights of pensioners to better health care, but asked them for a 5% levy to help finance it. And the pensioners' organizations here in Nicaragua agreed to that. But of course, that never got reported.
Right.
It was all just reported quite falsely as a neoliberal austerity measure.
Yeah.
When in fact, the people who would have had to pay the bulk of the increase were going to be the business classes. And that's why they walked out of the talks around that issue, precipitating the government's decision to go ahead with the reform regardless.
You know, that's one of the things anyway, because the people in the United States are ignorant of so much. And, you know, not I'm not going to place the blame on my fellow Americans, but rather on the institutions here that intentionally do this. But anyone that has any understanding of how the Sandinista government and the Sandinista party relates to the constituency, to the people, basically, would understand that this plan that was implemented was the result of an awful lot of information from the bottom up, an exchange and a conversation that went on with the people before they acted.
Sure.
That's the normal way they operate.
Yeah, I think there was consultation around what the priorities were, but there wasn't adequate consultation about how to implement the measure.
Physically, right. That's a bureaucratic... That's the thing that you generally make as a decision at the bureaucratic level, and unfortunately, that is where, in general, government tends to bungle.
Right. Well, that was certainly the case here. Anyway, despite people thinking they know what happened, and what's extraordinary about the relentless media onslaught in North America and Western Europe in particular against the Nicaraguan government, what's so extraordinary is that they leave out really fundamental facts about what has happened. Because if you read the North American media or the Western European media, the impression is that all the deaths that resulted from the attacks were the fault of the government, that the government started the violence by repressing peaceful demonstrations, and that subsequently the government has been completely intransigent, refusing to recognize the legitimate demands of the opposition, and that the brave, peaceful protesters throughout Nicaragua are now suffering a crackdown on their peaceful protests by the sinister repressive government of the dictator Daniel Ortega. That's the narrative. But in fact, for example, what was the first big lie? The first big lie, just as in Libya and Syria and elsewhere, was that the Nicaraguan government is massacring its own people. That was the first big lie. On April the 18th, social media reported a massacre of peacefully protesting students. Mm. In fact, nobody died on Wednesday the 18th. Mm. Subsequently, on April the 19th, the Thursday, three people died, and not one of them was a protester. So, and where did that the government's massacring its people come from? It was just a pure invention, right? So, yeah. And then subsequently, Daniel Ortega proposed dialogue around the social security reform, which was supposed to be the reason for the protests. And suddenly, oh no, that's not what we want. We want Daniel out. The demand shifted almost overnight from protests around the social security reform, which were entirely bogus, and the people protesting could hardly care less about what the social security reform, what they wanted right from the start, and subsequently came out in the first few days, was regime change. And they demanded that, and the right from the start, the protests were extremely violent. Attacks on municipal authority buildings across the country. What's that got to do with social security reform?
Right.
You know, and none of it was peaceful. And we've spoken in the past about the extreme level of violence in the country, and now that we've got to a point where the protests have petered out, and the police are back on the streets after having been withdrawn,
right,
as a precondition for the dialogue. There's so many aspects to this. We probably couldn't cover it even if we talked about it for four or five programs.
But there's a couple things worth parsing in that little point there. Okay, first of all, you know, this demand for the resignation of Ortega and of his government that comes about 18 months after he was reelected Ortega with 72% of the vote. Okay, so there has been no catastrophic change in the economic situation in Nicaragua, even though the United States has been feverishly since then attempting to pass what it calls the NICA law, which would isolate the banking system, try to throw the finance sector into chaos, try to deny some basic goods from ending up on the shelves in Nicaragua, etc., etc. Despite that, that hasn't had really any impact yet at all. There's been no other real change in the conditions of people's lives there in terms of a negative. In terms of the attempt to provoke a government response and make a claim like they did in Libya, for example, that the government is murdering the citizens, or like they did in Syria and they do elsewhere, when you get a couple of right-wing snipers shooting people at protests and blaming the government. When Ortega pulled the police out, what's happened is the situation became stabilized by the people themselves. In other words, peace has come on the ground because the people secured it for themselves.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth to that point of view. But one of the important things to understand is that there was a lot of momentum that generated by the social media campaign and the blanket. And another of the big lies is there's no freedom of expression and there's no free media in Nicaragua, you know, which is right. Just a pathetic joke.
Insane.
Because at least half the media are controlled by the opposition.
Yeah, the most powerful media, almost, I mean, the entire corporate media, in essence, is the opposition, so.
Well, and that's not entirely true, because I mean, the government has three or four very influential TV channels, but, right. and I think it's, in the Nicaraguan context, it's a mistake to put too much importance on the power of the main opposition media. The two big newspapers are owned by the opposition. Important TV channels, Canal 10, Canal 21, Canal 15, Canal 12, channel the 100% news, or 100% lies, they call it here. It's called the 100% news channel, but here people call it the 100% lies channel. but the importance of those media is not so much that they control people's perceptions directly, but that they feed into a network of local radio and local cable TV channels, right? And that was what, in my opinion, it was that mechanism, the feeding of the big lies from the most powerful Nicaraguan media, right, into the extremely malleable local radio news and cable TV news networks. For example, here in Esteli, there's a Cable Televisión, and that's owned by somebody loyal to the political opposition here. But, and a lot of people in Esteli follow that channel, that cable TV channel, and that's true in every city across Nicaragua. So they already had their network set up in order to feed their poison and their disinformation and their downright lies into the minds of the majority of people in Nicaragua. And for the first week, 2 weeks, maybe even 3 weeks, and people were fooled by that. But very quickly, the thing here is that people here in Nicaragua live often from day to day. The people at in the popular economy, they depend on income from one day to the next, or 1 week to the next. And very few people are able to say that they've got savings that will enable them to survive 2 or 3 months of economic hardship. That's not the case in Nicaragua.
Right.
So when the opposition generated crisis, especially the roadblocks that they set up to intimidate people and prevent normal economic life, as the effects of the opposition attack on Nicaragua's normal social and economic life developed, very, very quickly, ordinary people in Nicaragua started to be affected. And that's where your observation comes in about ordinary people in Nicaragua defeating the coup.
Right.
Now, that's not entirely true in the sense that people rose up against the people operating the roadblocks directly.
Right.
And that in places they did, here in Esteli they did. And that's how the roadblock here in Esteli was defeated. But the government, in order to restore normality, rather than sending out the police or even... And one thing to note is, if this had happened in El Salvador, Honduras or Guatemala, the first thing the government would have done would have declared a state of siege and imposed martial law.
Right.
But that didn't happen here. And that's one right. of the reasons why the death toll was so high, because the government didn't call out the army, and possibly leading to a situation where even more loss of life took place. They relied on the resilience of the people to resist the worst effects of the coup, and they tried to negotiate where they could negotiate with the opposition, and where they couldn't negotiate with the opposition, they didn't send in the police. The most serious example of that was in Masaya, in the area of Monimbo of Masaya, which was taken over by delinquent gangs. And I've got a friend there and his wife. You know, I didn't know very well before the crisis, but I was in constant touch with them through the crisis. And their reading of what happened in Masaya is very, very different, the complete opposite of what you read in the mainstream media.
Right.
And the nitty-gritty is that the government has managed to defeat the coup, disperse the delinquents who are operating the roadblocks, and that's another lie. For example, the mainstream media say the students that were at the head of the protests, that now that was true maybe for a week, at the most 2 weeks, but subsequent to that, the violent intimidation, the incidences of torture, the of people often at the roadblocks, the phenomenon of the Catholic Church harboring these delinquents in their churches, harboring their weapons and allowing their churches to be used as centers of torture. Don, there's videos all over the internet
of people
being tortured in churches here in Nicaragua.
It's just so amazing, right?
So and the mainstream media of course cover all that up. They cover up the fact that over 60 schools were attacked and damaged during the course of the crisis. They cover up the fact that 22 police were murdered and 400 police suffered gunshot injuries, right? Now, what would happen in the United States with that level of violence against the police? Do you think that the army wouldn't be called out? Of course they would.
Oh, please, just the threat that that wasn't necessarily even made by them, but the threat that hung out in the culture of Black Panthers, defending the community by killing the pigs, that enabled, preemptive raids, raids on Black Panthers where they would, come in, shoot machine guns into an apartment, and then go inside and see, who did they turn into Swiss cheese, like Fred Hampton and others. And that wasn't based on the Panthers actually doing anything to
Of course, you're still in the United States. You're still living the legacy of that with figures like Mumia Abu-Jamal and many others.
Or Tamir Rice, a 6-year-old kid or whatever who happens to have a water pistol outside and gets shot to death.
Right. So, and of course, in the United States, that reality is completely misrepresented. And so we shouldn't be surprised that the reality in Nicaragua is completely misrepresented.
Right.
But that level of violence also completely changed public opinion over the course of the 3 months of the crisis. And while for now the coup has been defeated internally, and how do we know it's been defeated? Because there's just massive popular rejection of the coup mongers, massive popular support for the government. And the last week was July the 19th, the anniversary of the 39th anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution back in 1979 that overthrew the dictatorship. And that's another thread that you come across constantly in the mainstream media, the comparison with Daniel Ortega, between Daniel Ortega and Anastasio Somoza, as if there's any comparison at all. It's just completely insidious and sinister and absurd in the most unjust way. But for example, on July 19th, the BBC, instead of covering the hundreds of thousands of people that packed Managua's Plaza de la Fe, the faith plaza, here and all the way up the main boulevard in Managua that runs down to the lake, that's called the boulevard from Chavez to Bolivar. Instead of covering that massive outpouring of support for the government, the BBC on their website ran an absurd comparison between Daniel Ortega and Anastasio Somoza. And then at the same time on the 19th, because of the threat of opposition violence attacking people that would have traveled normally, there'd be huge caravans of people traveling down to Managua from all the rural areas of the country. But this year they decided not to do that because it was too dangerous because of the opposition violence and the threat of ambushes of people, as happened on May 30th when a caravana from here, from Esteli and points north, was ambushed by opposition gunmen. That wasn't reported by the mainstream media. One Sandinista supporter was killed, and 20 people were wounded and had to be taken to hospital. by opposition gunmen, these supposed peaceful protesting students.
Right.
You know, just a complete lie. So anyway, instead of those normal caravans traveling down to Managua for the 19th, they held local municipal celebrations of the 39th anniversary of the revolution. And there too, there was massive support in all the main urban centers, León, Matagalpa, Hinotega, Ocotal, Esteli, Huigalpa, and all those places, and over on the Caribbean coast. For the anniversary, but none of that was reported, of course not. And then nor was there any reporting of the pathetic turnout on Saturday the 21st by the opposition, who at the start of the protests were able to mobilize around 30,000 or maybe even more people on their marches in Managua. But on July the 21st, they barely managed to get together a march of 1,000 people. So, and the popular support for the opposition has collapsed and may even be lower than the levels that they enjoyed before the crisis, which, right. You know, electorally they have about 30-35% in elections.
Right.
But their core support is down around between 10-20%.
I mean, there's a logic to that, because people that suffered through the last few months, as it became clear exactly what was happening. You know, you have the same phenomenon that you saw in Venezuela when the right became so emboldened that they attacked the Supreme Court by smashing a helicopter into it, or whatever the hell it was, the aircraft that they did. Now, can I ask you something about the mediascape there? I know that the Sandinistas, from the beginning, I mean, we're going back to even before 1979, really, in the areas that they were able to secure, encouraged and trained people in literacy. They taught the people to read, and there was a heavy emphasis on this as a part of integrating people into, you know, public and political life as well. And so the newspapers play a larger role there than they do in some other countries where, you know, people are, you know, not first world industrial powers. There is it still La Prensa, El Nuevo Diario, and Barricada that are the main newspapers?
Yeah, and Barricada folded way back in the early 1990s.
That's gone. Okay, so you have La Prensa is kind of the opposition newspaper, and El Nuevo Diario.
It's the business newspaper, and El Nuevo Diario are the business. La Prensa is basically a fiefdom of the Chamorro family.
Right.
Carlos Fernando Chamorro is a very influential journalist, won prizes from the Columbia School of Journalism, which tells you a lot about what he is. Mm. You know, and United States journalism is a joke, as we can see from their coverage of just about any foreign news crisis.
Right.
But And he's funded, he and his media group are basically an NGO. He runs an outfit called Confidencial and another NGO called Cinco that promotes media training. And those are heavily funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and other United States foundations, as is the Chamorro Foundation, that belongs to the Chamorro family. And you have to remember that the Chamorros are an oligarchic family.
Right.
Who, and the word from way back, and there's even a treaty called the Chamorro-Bryan Treaty, whereby a forebear of Carlos Fernando and Juan Sebastian and all the rest of the Chamorros gave away Nicaragua's sovereignty in a treaty agreeing with the United States not to allow a canal to be built without the permission of the United States.
Right.
That's way back, 1907, 1908.
1914, yeah.
So that's what the Chamorros are. So anyway, look, the key things that I should have stated are that although the coup has been defeated, the violent provocations are very likely to continue because they need them to fuel the campaign at an international level that will facilitate a sanctions regime against Nicaragua, very similar to the one that they've instituted against Venezuela and the one that they've maintained against Cuba for over 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I would just point out, and I'm piling on to that particular point, that when the coup was defeated in April of 2002, certainly the efforts to take down Venezuela did not end. They continue till today, and that's the way they're going to play until Washington itself collapses. Thank you very much, Tony, for a very interesting discussion, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.